My purpose is to help stir up some creative thinking, now lacking, about effects of time and change on city neighborhoods. Above all, to stir up thinking about how to enlist time and change as practical allies, not as enemies that must be regulated out and fended off on the one hand, or messily surrendered to on the other.
Jane Jacobs is perhaps one of the most influential urbanists of our time. Her writing inspired and still inspires city planners, architects, and communities all around the world. At a time when urban planning was male-dominated, she decided to break the mold to become an activist and urban champion for a community-based approach to city building. 2016 would have seen her 100th birthday. So, as the year nears the end, join us on this week's special episode of The Urbanist, looking back at the life and legacy of the great Jane Jacobs. And we start with Dr. Peter Lawrence, Associate Professor of Architectural and Urban History at Clemson University School of Architecture. And he's also the author of Becoming Jane Jacobs.
She was born in 1916 in Scranton, Pennsylvania, a city that was located a pretty short distance from New York, a bit of geography that really impacted her biography. And her upbringing in what was effectively, what was really a mining town, was a short drive from New York City. That's where she grew up. But as soon as she had the opportunity to leave Scranton, I think she was ready to do that before she turned 18, but her parents had her wait until she turned 18 years old. But as soon as the opportunity and parents allowed, she moved to New York City. She spent her first just number of months in Brooklyn, where her sister was already living. And as Jane explored the city as an 18-year-old, looking for work as a writer, because that was her career ambition from a very young age. Even as a youth, she was very interested in writing. And when she moved to New York, it was with the ambition of beginning a writing career. And when she arrived in the city, she searched for work. The difficulty, of course, was that it was the Great Depression, and finding any work was very difficult, let alone work for a junior reporter or a junior editorial assistant or something of that nature. She just couldn't find that kind of work. So the relationship of the city and her writing career began almost immediately, not just in the search for work, but as she explored the city, she was looking at the neighborhoods, and she decided, with a job or no job, she would start writing. And from the time she was 18 and 19, 20 years old, she wrote a series of essays about what she called the working districts of Manhattan. And these, again, were mostly in Lower Manhattan. And these were places like the Flower District and the Diamond District, in neighborhoods of New York City that were in Manhattan, that were known for specialized kinds of work, specialized kinds of enterprises. And these neighborhoods fascinated her in ways that are quite familiar with her interests later in life. What she was looking at was the combination of the ways that the city and people and economic enterprises were interconnected and interrelated. And this was a lifelong interest that manifested itself already from the time she was 18 years old. It's a quite remarkably consistent set of interests. These neighborhoods, as working districts, as she called them, represented a way that the city, even New York City in particular, even in the Depression, maintained a kind of vitality that was very grassroots, it was very bottom-up. Again, in the way that people and their ambitions and their local businesses were very much the life of the city, even in difficult economic times.
My name is Stacey Anderson, and I'm the Director of Public Programs for the Municipal Arts Society of New York. We have a very robust walking tour program. We were actually the first organization in New York City to give a walking tour. And I know this concept is very popular today, but at the time it was kind of revolutionary to take to the streets and kind of observe things from the sidewalk level.
Have been made into really a wide sidewalks. It was for window shopping, for sitting around in.
And I think she really represents a set of principles that are the bedrock of contemporary, you know, kind of urban planning. And a couple of those, you know, are essentially that she really understood that good planning required keen observation of your surroundings, of your context. So she, at the time, was really challenging the conventional orthodox approach to urban planning, which was very top-down. You know, here goes a tree, you know, here is where we'll plant a tree, and here's where we'll put a bench, with little regard around how the individual would actually operate and move through that space. And what she did was she sat on a bench in the West Village and just watched kind of urban life unfold in front of her, and thereby induced these principles which guide the field of urban planning today. So I think her human-centric approach to planning was hugely influential and is very much an inspiration for urban planning and urban design today. Jane's Walk takes place every year. It's the first weekend in May, and this coming year it will be the 6th, 7th, and 8th, Friday through Sunday, and we hope to have over 100 walking tours all around the city, Bronx, Brooklyn, Staten Island even. We hope people make it out there as well. In New York, we've been producing Jane's Walk. We've been the local chapter for Jane's Walk since 2007, I want to say. And every year it's just grown exponentially because it's really very low barrier to access. So you really don't have to be a historian or a trained tour guide by any means. In fact, we encourage just the average individual that has a passion for the city and perhaps a very idiosyncratic, esoteric interest to share that in the form of a Jane's Walk. And so we provide the platform and the tools for people to self-organize, essentially, which again comes back to this kind of Jacobsian approach to planning, which is this idea that everyone should have the capacity to participate. And this past year, we had over 200 walking tours around New York. And it's everyone from, you know, artists to foodies to musicians to historians to, you know, long-term residents that have witnessed the changes in their neighborhood and are eager to discuss that with their neighbors. I can speak from my own experience that there's an almost irony in the fact that Jane Jacobs made us appreciate the diversity and the kind of cultural vibrancy of these neighborhoods, which are now subject to being gentrified, if that makes sense, because that is now attractive. And there was something that was so undervalued at a certain point in time when Robert Moses was touting his approach to planning. And so it's the West Village itself, which at that point in time was considered to be slum conditions and is now the kind of at the nexus of this debate around gentrification, because it is so desirable, that kind of mixed diversity and the beautiful streetscape, the low scale kind of granular urbanism that happens there. So we're greatly indebted to her because she's made us appreciate these things to such a degree that now everybody wants to live in those places, and by virtue of that is resulting in the displacement of long-term residents. And that is part of the urban evolution, though, that I think she would also say is part of the natural course of life of a city, because once a city stops changing and stops evolving, then it's dead, and then it's no longer the kind of living organism that makes cities such special places.
This isn't a dead city. This isn't a dead city.
My name is Lauren Spokane from the Municipal Arts Society of New York. So earlier this year, we had this goal of trying to illustrate Jane Jacobs, her principles. She wrote The Life and Death of Great American Cities, and obviously it's an easy-to-read book, but we wanted to try to extract some of her key principles and put them in a simple format to understand. So we partnered with Project for Public Spaces in Curbed, New York, and we worked with this Australian / New York based graphic designer named James Gulliver Hancock. And we created this, I mean, to me, quite beautiful poster that colorfully and in a visually appealing way shows what she really stood for. She wanted to try skateboarding. That was something, that was one of her life goals. I don't know if she ever got the opportunity to do it, but I think that shows something about her character.
And the famous Bob, for those who know what she looks like. Yeah. She was known for her cat eye glasses and her impeccable bob.
Well, I had this idea that the way to find out how cities really should be planned and organized would be to look and see how they worked, successfully.
Jane's thinking knows no borders, and her legacy is the prime example of that. She never lived in the UK, yet her work manages to influence and inspire people on this side of the pond too.
She's the patron saint of urbanistas for a reason, and that's because her work is entirely relevant. In fact, it's probably more relevant than ever. My name's Leanne Hartley, and I'm director of MEND, a very small social enterprise that covers responsible procurement and planning. And I'm also founder of Urbanistas, which is a global network of women engaged in cities. What unites all urbanistas is this passion for making cities better for everybody. So not just for women, and it's not necessarily about women's issues as such. It's this desire to make cities more accessible and more inclusive. So with that kind of premise, we find that our network is just incredibly diverse. We have women from all walks of life, all professions, all backgrounds, all ages, all interests. And I think that sums up really where I think Jane's influence comes from, which is that cities aren't just the preserve of planners or engineers or architects. Everybody's got a role to play in remaking and making cities. Cities are incredibly complex. They follow their own rules. They seem to exist in this state of comfortable chaos. Whenever you try to impose any kind of order upon them, they seem to sort of swerve it quite easily. And I was struck with, well, you have this quite rigid, systematic approach to cities. And I felt instinctively that there was another element to that, there was another dimension to that, which is humans and how we behave and how we experience cities. And really, Jane was the first time where I'd read a sort of critique of cities, if you like, that really spoke to me, really resonated. And it was incredibly human. It talked about mistakes and failure. It talked about things being imperfect and about things being informal, about this sort of spontaneity and ballet and dance of life that happens on our city streets. And as a planner, as training to be a planner, I was struck, well, how do you actually manufacture that? How do you plan for that sort of sense of chaos and spontaneity? It's very difficult.
She wasn't definitely an observer. She's well known as a great observer. And that is something that we say about her in, I think, contrast to an academic education. So she understood, I think, in a historical sense, something about the city's history even then. It wasn't that she went into these neighborhoods, and we see this in these early essays, and they were strictly just observational. She was discussing the history of these places. Although she was not formally educated, she was very well read. Her oldest son once said to me, in terms of what Jane read, it was much better to assume that she had read it than she hadn't. That's maybe a bit of hyperbole, but it for me as a biographer, it shaped an attitude towards expecting more of her and her knowledge than the other way around, and moderating her this idea of her as strictly an observer, which I think in some ways doesn't really take her into her full account as an intellectual.
The first thing to bear in mind is obviously the irony that Jane wasn't necessarily trained as a planner herself, yet had this incredible insight into how cities' dynamics work. I think what Jane was a pioneer in doing was enabling that kind of activist planner, that sort of planner who enables communities to come to their own decisions and actually fight for what they want, which even today we struggle with sort of 50, 60 years later. It's still very difficult to reconcile plans with the desire of the community. I often think, I wonder if the absence or lack of urban studies maybe did her a favour. She might have felt unencumbered by the kind of orthodoxies of planning as they were then and felt freer to exercise her own judgment.
From very early on, she was not interested in formal education, so she wasn't interested in going to college when she had graduated high school. But what we're most familiar with about her in terms of her education is the experience and the story she told about leaving Columbia University, which was that she, as a non-degree student, had taken the maximum number of courses that were allowed, and then she was required to apply. And she was not admitted as a degree student. And this was the beginning of a lifelong resentment and half a lifetime of criticism, at least, of higher education. She was really a theorist and a philosopher of sorts about the nature of education, and was, at least we can say, felt very strongly about the distinguishing between becoming educated and becoming credentialed or earning a degree. One of the first battles in New York City was the Washington Square Park battle, and she joined that battle a few years into it. And one of the things that I show in my book is, in fact, that as part of the development of her career, she was actually quite busy looking at other cities in the early 50s before she became involved in the very local battle to save Washington Square Park from an extension of Fifth Avenue, a plan proposed by Robert Moses, which was in fact part of a much larger plan for Greenwich Village. Part of the reason to connect Fifth Avenue was not just traffic circulation, but Moses was planning a very large housing project south of the park. So that was her first battle, and she joined an existing organizing infrastructure that had started in the early 50s, around 1955, 56. And by that point, it was a turning point in her thinking about cities around those same years, 55, 56, when her ideas and understanding of urban renewal was changing rapidly. In the early 50s, when the choices for Americans were really between investing in suburban growth or investing in the rehabilitation of cities, she favored, as did many, she favored urban renewal, or really urban redevelopment at that time, as it was known, and later urban renewal. But in the mid-decade, her thinking about this began to change, and as it was at the same time, the Washington Square battle itself was part of that turning point for her. So from that point forward, with Washington Square Park in the background as a local battle, her ideas about cities were changing dramatically.
Toronto's a very refreshing city to come to from the States. It's all full of romanticism and quirks and surprises and ingenuity.
In 1968 and 1969, Jacobs moved to Toronto, and quickly she once again became an active voice of and in defense of the city.
My name is Denise Pinto. I'm executive director of the Jane's Walk Project. In the year after Jane Jacobs passed away, in 2006 she passed away, 2007 the project started, admirers of her work and people who believed in her vision decided to explore an idea to carry her legacy on through an action, and that action was walking. So they got together 27 walk leaders in the first year, and they asked them to provide public walking tours, because Jane was a huge proponent of people observing what was around them, looking carefully at streets and cities. People were fascinated that the places that they felt such familiarity with, when seen through the eyes of their neighbors, completely transformed. So you could walk a place every day of your life and then walk with somebody else and see it in a completely new way, and open yourself to details that you didn't know existed and meet people who you didn't know were there. And so it's kind of confronting us with the idea that we may feel a place is very familiar, but there's so much more to discover, and cities are such complex places that it's this peeling back of the layers that's really interesting. And in the 10 years since the project has been around, it's been marvelous the way that it's opened up this sense of empathy at a community level. She first came over here, moving her family to escape the draft for the Vietnam War. And so she had been doing a lot of activism around preventing the Manhattan Expressway from razing a number of really critical neighborhoods in a neighborhood she lived in. And then she gets to Toronto, and the same thing happens here. She moves into the Annex neighborhood and finds out that the Spadina Expressway is about to jeopardize the very community that she's landed in. So I don't think she had a choice. She had to grapple with this idea. She gets to Toronto and people are looking to her for leadership. But in chatting with people that knew her quite closely, I've come to understand that she very much saw herself as part of a community of people that were doing this, not as the front runner, but as one person who was committed to hearing from everybody and who maybe acted as an example or a beacon for that, but saw herself as part of a community-driven effort. Toronto has a great love for her. Through this project and through this work, I've seen a number of different generations experience her legacy in different ways. The people that were her cohorts are certainly holding to, you know, potentially a very personal connection with Jane, what she stood for, the conversations they had with her, and the good work that they did with her. And I'm constantly inspired having conversations with them. And then I would say I'm part of this generation that is affectionately termed the young urbanists. And so there's a kind of different perspective that Jane left us with, and that's one that I think speaks to equity, to a drive towards opening up the city, opening up the conversation around the city to everyone, and that is so important because we can't understand what the needs of the city are unless we challenge ourselves to understand competing needs and to understand how one person can see a streetscape and another person can see the very same place and have such different requirements of that space.
Cities have the capability of providing something for everybody, only because and only when they are created by everybody.
But perhaps what projected Jacobs' work to an international scale was the publication of her iconic book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. Published in 1961, it's still just as relevant today and continues to be treasured by urbanists around the globe.
Death and Life of Great American Cities was absolutely the beginning of a trajectory of writing that is more consistent and more, I would almost say, planned out, but a step-by-step evolution and exploration of a series of ideas. Urbanists are very familiar with the conditions for city diversity that Jacobs writes about in part two of the book, the need for mixed uses and the need for small blocks, the need for aged buildings, and the need for concentration. And we think about these as really principles of urbanism. But Jacobs, and she says this, it's somewhat easy for urbanists to overlook. She says these are really economic principles. And we know this in part because of aged buildings. This was not about historic preservation. But aged buildings for her really had a lot to do with low rents that were important for people of diverse economic needs. So we see in Death and Life her getting ready to write the next book, The Economy of Cities, and Cities and the Wealth of Nations follows very, very logically from that. And all of these themes culminate in certain ways in her last book, Dark Age Ahead, another book that is, I think, frighteningly appropriate for our time.
We seem to lack this kind of angry voice around what's happening in our cities, and a lot of the public space that we're seeing being eroded seems to happen almost by stealth. I think Jane would be very exercised about those sort of issues and how space fights over space in terms of accessibility are being fought everywhere.
Not TV or illegal drugs, but the automobile has been the chief destroyer of American communities.
And Dark Age Ahead was a book when it came out. It was a book that she was written when she was in her 80s. I think she knew she didn't have many books ahead of her at that point. So it was a book that wasn't really well received for the way it was edited and the way it was written. But 10 years later, after the election, we can look at the themes she was exploring about the ways that communities were set up to fail. She was thinking about the nature of public education and education in general. It's an enormous debate in the United States, and that ties into the electoral politics that are being analyzed in great depth today in terms of voting demographics and the fact that two-thirds of Americans don't have a college degree. So she was thinking about public education. She was thinking about, in a chapter called Science Abandoned, the direction towards a post-fact world, post-fact discourses we're talking about now, let alone the dramatic attacks on science, scientific thinking as an institution. She talked about self-policing subverted, which touches on some of the problems that the U.S. faces in terms of policing and the nature of keeping civil society together and working. And so on. So we see in this book a lot of themes that are extraordinarily relevant. And if we take the title seriously, A Dark Age Ahead, and if we also take the durability of her work seriously, then we ought to be extremely concerned about what she had to say.
Jane's work is such a beautiful call for us to open our eyes, to not dig our heels in, but to understand that the city's needs change and that we should constantly be looking for ways to reread the places that we know, and that we should constantly be thinking of, you know, what our own biases are in that space if we are to create a place that works for everybody. So that's one thing that I think looks very different depending on which generation you are speaking to.
The life and legacy of the great Jane Jacobs, who still inspires us all. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by Weidong Lin, Claire Crofton, and George McDonough. Additional reporting was by Clarissa Farr in New York and Thomas Lewis in Toronto. Our thanks go out to them. Next week, Tall Stories goes for a little Christmas break, but The Urbanist will be back as usual at 1900 hours on Thursday. You can download the show or subscribe via monocle.com, SoundCloud, Spotify, or even iTunes. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Stevie Wonder with Living for the City. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
A boy is born in hot damn Mississippi, surrounded by for one that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong, moving in.